Okay, so this is the second half of the lecture on the seventh. And what I'd like to do is shift gears a little bit and talk about control of respiration. Because I've been talking about respiration rate, for instance, and I haven't talked much about control. This is a picture from 1333, from your text, 1333. And this shows something that must look rather familiar to you by now, since we had a similar picture in the circulatory chapter. And this is showing you nerves that lead from the aortic bodies to the brainstem, to the respiratory center in the brainstem. Remember, we had the medullary cardiovascular center. Well, there's also a medullary respiratory center. So I'm going to refresh your memories as to what happens on inspiration. The diaphragm, which is this dome-shaped sort of slab of skeletal muscle, contracts and it gets flatter. And the external intercostal muscles that are between the ribs, you know, when you eat barbecued ribs, those are intercostal muscles you're eating. So the intercostals contract, and that raises the rib cage. So we have the rib cage raising itself up, and we have the diaphragm going down, which has the net effect of increasing the volume of the thoracic chamber, which does what to the pressure? Decreases the pressure. Now, when you breathe out, if you remember, that was something I showed you at about 2 minutes to four last Thursday, so you might not. When you breathe out, it's not a matter of contraction of muscles. It's a matter of relaxation. So we have the diaphragm contracting, and it relaxes. And we have the intercostal muscles contracting, and they relax. And so we have the volume of the thorax going back to where it was before, causing the pressure to increase. If you want to breathe forcefully, most breathing is like that, contraction of the diaphragm and intercostals and then relaxation. If you want to breathe very forcefully, for instance, everybody put your finger up as if it were a candle. There's a flame on top. Imagine a flame on top of the candle. Now blow it out. Okay, you just used your internal intercostal muscles, which are your expiratory intercostals. They are not used for everyday expiration. They are only used for forced expiration. If you want to blow out a candle, if you want to blow a steady stream on your coffee to cool it off, or if you want to dry off, you know, you go in one of those bathrooms where they don't have paper towels. They have these electricity-using, heat-generating things that you're supposed to, you know, just, actually, I just do this. But if you want to blow something off for any reason, then you might use those expiratory muscles. And what that does is that actually causes the rib cage to quickly and forcefully get even smaller, which then forces the air out in a forceful fashion. That's why you can blow out all the candles on your birthday cake. But that is not the usual way that we expirate. Now, if you are exercising very, very heavily and you have a high metabolic need to get oxygen in and out fast, your breathing rate might increase, yes, but it can't be shallow, and you have to get rid of that air. So if you've been running for a long time or playing basketball for a long time, I don't know if you guys do any, I mean, I do this when I ride my cycle. As you breathe, as you need more air to move in and out faster, your expiratory muscles actually do start contracting, and you start breathing out more forcefully than you do usually. And that is the evolutionary reason for the internal intercostals. It's not to blow out candles or to cool off your latte. It's to get rid of air when you need to get rid of it quickly. So it's a forceful exhalation. And what controls the movement of those skeletal muscles are motor neurons. So we do have control over our inspiration and expiration. For instance, hold your breath. Breathe in, hold your breath. Now let it out slowly. You did that consciously. So you have control over what's going on. But when you're asleep, do you have to think about breathing? Good thing, huh? You wouldn't get much rest if you had to stay up all night saying, okay, I have to control my breathing. And so what happens is your medullary inspiratory neurons kick in and they do it automatically, rhythmically. And the stimuli for these neurons are concentrations of oxygen, CO2, and hydrogen. And I thought I had a wonderful overhead that showed this. Yes, I do. Table 13.9 from your text. And this shows you the different sensors. Remember in that previous picture, it showed the aortic bodies. Well, we've got chemoreceptors that taste the blood to see where it is. So in the carotids and aorta, we have these chemoreceptors that can tell when there's less O2. They can also tell when there's more hydrogen, and they can also tell when the CO2 concentration has increased. So the peripheral chemoreceptors in the aorta and the carotids actually will send information to the brain saying, hey, look, there's a lot of hydrogen in the blood right now. Might want to step up the respiration rate. Problem is, you can get hydrogen from other things. For instance, you could eat really acidic food and have some hydrogens be absorbed into the bloodstream. You could, in exercising a lot, make a lot of lactic acid, in which case you probably would want to increase your breathing rate. But you don't need to increase your breathing rate just because you had a glass of lemonade. So there is a different kind of chemoreceptor called the central chemoreceptor. And the central chemoreceptor is located in the medulla, beyond the blood-brain barrier. And what happens is the central chemoreceptors are responding to the pH change based not on hydrogen ions, but actually on CO2. And you know why? Because the central chemoreceptors cannot get the hydrogens. Ah, here it is. This is a non-Vander picture. And what's going on here is the the hydrogen cannot go through the blood-brain barrier into the medulla because of what? The blood-brain barrier and the fact that it is polar, it's downright ionic, and evidently there aren't a whole bunch of transporters for transporting hydrogens into the brain. Well, there aren't. But the CO2 in the blood can diffuse across these layers of cell membrane easily because, folks, gases don't need to be transported. That is really important. I wish I had a dollar for every person who said on the final exam that the CO2 was actively transported. It isn't. It just diffuses down its gradient. And so what happens is these central chemoreceptors in the medulla are responding to the concentration of CO2 in the blood. But look, here's how they do it. The CO2 diffuses across the blood-brain barrier into the cerebrospinal fluid, where it combines with oxygen to form carbonic acid, which quickly dissociates into bicarb and hydrogen, and they respond to the hydrogen. But they're not responding to hydrogen that is not related to CO2. So they're not responding to the hydrogen that might be in your blood because of diet or some other factor. They're responding to hydrogen that forms because of the presence of CO2. So which of the chemoreceptors, this peripheral or the central chemoreceptors, do you think the medulla will listen to most if the two chemoreceptors are sensing different things? The central. The central chemoreceptors rule because of this blood-brain barrier thing. Oh, gosh. So much more. Okay, I think what I'll do is I will show you this. This is an old banner. I don't believe they have this now. And look at that tiny print. If you don't have your glasses on, good luck to you. I can hardly read it myself. Holy mackerel. Okay, so here we have the medulla, and we have the medullary respiratory center, and we have an area that's involved with inspiration, and we have an area that's involved with expiration, and those two areas have connections so they can talk to each other. And then you have a variety of neurons that are important to governing the skeletal muscle. So we have nerves that go to the intercostal muscles for expiration and nerves that go to the intercostal muscles for inspiration. We have the phrenic nerve, which goes to the diaphragm. I don't know if you can see that. It might be hard to see. I'll get a colored pen and draw that for you. Here's the phrenic nerve. Are these ones we have conscious control over? No. These are just going to kind of do their own thing. And the reason I'm showing this to you is I want to show you a picture that I believe might still be in Vander, or maybe not. So here we have inspiration and expiration. And this is the phrenic nerve I just showed you. And these are action potential patterns on the phrenic nerve. And remember, the external intercostal muscles are the ones that we inspire with. It's kind of the opposite of what you expect, but just think external inspiration, internal expiration. So the external intercostal muscles then get a certain pattern of action potential. Is not much happening on the internal intercostal nerves. And we just have, what do we call this when we're just quietly breathing? Tidal. This is the tidal breathing or tidal volume. And then if we have an increased need to get more oxygen and get rid of more CO2, then we step up the action potential pattern for the external intercostals. And still, again, not a whole lot happening on the internals. Then if we get into a really high metabolic need to get rid of oxygen or get rid of air fast, then we have this excited pattern along the phrenic nerve and along the external intercostal nerves. And then there's a lot more activity along the internal intercostal nerve to the internal or expiratory intercostals. So it's all done by patterns and frequencies of action potentials. I think one reason that they got rid of this picture is the way it's drawn, it almost looks like you've got action potentials that have higher amplitude. Is that possible? No. So that's probably why they ditched that picture. Okay, this is 1340 from your book, Gesundheit. And this shows you some of the major chemical inputs that stimulate breathing. So when we talk about ventilation, we're not talking about opening the window. We're talking about breathing. And you'll notice that you will have the amount of oxygen, the partial pressure of oxygen in the air will influence the peripheral chemoreceptors, as will all kinds of acids, including non-CO2 acids. And then the central chemoreceptors respond just to acids created from CO2. And those both will influence the firing of the medullary inspiratory neurons. and will increase the number of contractions or the rate of contraction of the diaphragm and the inspiratory intercostals. This is a good one. I like this kind of a table, this kind of a flow chart. It's pretty clear what's going on, isn't it? I'm telling you that for a reason. You will know why in a minute. Okay, what's this? You'll do this as you get older. You play trombone with people. Okay, exercise and ventilation. This is 1341 from your book. And this shows what different changes that occur as you increase your O2 consumption with exercise. So at the bottom, we're going from rest to maximal exercise. And on, up the vertical, we have four different graphs, actually. We have the amount of hydrogen ion in the blood, probably CO2 related. We have the amount of CO2 in the blood, and we have the amount of oxygen, and we have the number of respirations per minute, or actually the amount of air respired per minute. So it's the minute ventilation, which is the number of respirations times the volume that you're breathing. So it's in liters per minute. And you can see as you exercise, you use a whole lot more, or you bring in a lot more air because you're using a lot more oxygen. And the middle is about moderate exercise. So this is moderate exercise, and then you notice that the slope gets a lot steeper as you exercise more vigorously. This is an interesting one. This shows a person at rest beginning to exercise. Look at this vertical element of the minute ventilation. Now, if this were in response to metabolic need, you would expect a more gradual increase in the ventilation rate. But you get this sudden increase in ventilation rate. And then at the end of exercise, you have a sudden drop-off in your ventilation rate, but it doesn't go back to the one you had at the beginning of ventilation. What is this? What's that thing at the beginning? Why do we start breathing faster when we even just have started exercising? Feed-forward mechanism. Yes, it's caused by neural input from the central nervous system to the medullary respiratory center, and it even though you may not need to breathe faster all of a sudden because you're still not using that much oxygen, you will start breathing faster because the body's been there before. You'll see this in trained athletes especially. Anybody have this happen to you? Like when you go over to start picking up that really heavy weight, do you start breathing heavily before you even pick it up? I've seen that in some weightlifters. Also, what's happening here? We have a sudden reduction in the ventilation rate, but we haven't gone back to the original resting rate. What is this difference here? Error signal. Why do we need an error signal here? Just think, you've just run a couple of miles and then you sit down, which is probably a bad idea. You shouldn't just sit down. You should do stretching exercises and cool off. But let's say you just stopped this exercise and sat down and started drinking a beer. Also a bad idea. Because it dehydrates your tissues. But why the sudden reduction in ventilation rate is understandable. Why doesn't it go back to here? Your cells are still going through the oxidative phosphorylation, aren't they? Because they were really cranking out those ATPs really fast, and there may also be an ATP deficit in the tissues that has to be remedied. And then you see that what happens is it slowly returns after you have been resting for a while to the original set point. I like this graph because it sort of attends to stuff we talked about the first week. It's nice when they all connect. Okay, and this shows factors that stimulate ventilation during exercise. And you see that you have motor neurons directly stimulating the skeletal muscle. And you also have motor cortex information going down to the medulla, to the respiratory center, which also is taking in the concentrations of various components in the blood, like oxygen, CO2, and hydrogen, is also getting information from temperature receptors and conditioned response. That's that learned response that I was talking about that probably gives you that feed forward. And then also, as you exercise, you will probably have an increase in epinephrine, because the exercise stimulates ACTH release from the brain as well as endorphins, and that will cause the, that gives you cortisol, sorry. That will cause an outflow of the sympathetic to the medulla of the adrenal glands, which will cause an increase in epinephrine. And also you have sensory info from the joints, and the respiratory center gets all of this stuff, and it puts it together, and it gives off certain kinds of action potential signals to the various neurons leading to the breathing apparatus. It's not familiar. Okay, I think uno mas on this topic, and then we'll go into kidneys. Oh no, wait, that is kidneys. We're almost done. Okay. So now these are terms not from your book. Please do not memorize these. And I only show it to you to show you that these are different respiratory states. Apnea means you just don't breathe. Temporarily, you stop breathing. Remember we talked about sleep apnea? Asphyxia means you don't have oxygen in tissues that need it, and usually caused because you cannot breathe. And there are various causes of asphyxiation, sometimes because you're in a room full of car exhaust or because you have asthma and your conducting pathways have shut down on you. Could be because you're hyperventilating and you still have enough oxygen, but you will actually cause problems because too much oxygen will actually go to the brain and damage some of its function or interfere with some of its function. Hypoxia, we already talked about. Suffocation is oxygen deprivation as a result of inability to breathe oxygenated air. So I want you to compare suffocation with asphyxia. So asphyxia is oxygen starvation of the tissues, and there can be a number of reasons. One could be suffocation. Another one could be too much CO, too much carbon monoxide. I'm not going to show that to you anymore because I can see some of you are copying it down, and I don't want you to. Okay, stand up. Take a big, deep breath. Stretch. Okay, sit down. Now, we had a little chat up here earlier, and people were saying, let's just skip the kidneys. And I'm not going to, because they are more important to you than the reproductive system. Well, maybe not personally, but you can easily live your entire life without your reproductive system. You cannot live very long at all without your renal system. So let's talk about the functions of the kidneys. This is table 14.1 from your textbook. This tells you all the different functions. You thought the kidneys just made urine. Well, folks, that is a very important function, but they do a lot more. For instance, they regulate the water and ion balance in your blood. They remove waste products like urea from the blood and get rid of them by excreting in the urine. They also remove water. And I'm looking on this and I'm not seeing anything about blood pressure, but your kidneys do play a role in blood pressure because they will remove, for instance, salts at a greater rate. And what did I tell you about salt and water? Water follows salt. So if we excrete more salt from the kidneys, we will excrete more water, and then that will reduce the blood volume, reducing the blood pressure. We'll get into more details of how the kidneys influence blood pressure. They also clean out foreign materials, and some of those foreign materials may be things like drugs, antibiotics, for instance, or vitamin C, excess vitamin C. So they actually take chemicals from the blood and make sure that the blood does not have these inappropriate levels of certain chemicals. So people say, oh, well, if one vitamin C tablet is good, I'm going to take five. And what you end up doing is having the most expensive urine in the world because you spend a lot of money on those tablets and it just gets pulled out of the kidneys and thrown into the urine. Oh ho, there's a cool thing. Kidneys actually make new sugars out of amino acids. It's called gluconeogenesis. So when you are in a state of too little sugar, you're in a metabolic state where you are experiencing either zero intake of carbohydrates or a large use of sugars without appropriate provisioning, then your kidneys will actually make new sugars, and your nervous system uses sugar preferentially for making ATP. They also produce hormones and enzymes. For instance, the kidneys make erythropoietin. I've told you about erythropoietin. Erythropoietin actually stimulates the bone marrow to make red blood cells. Oops, I'm in the way, sorry. Okay, so the bone marrow responds to something made by the kidneys, which is really bizarro. The renin story. I'm going to tell you in detail, probably not today, probably tomorrow, the renin-angiotensin axis, and I want you to know that puppy, because it's really interesting. Renin is a chemical made in the kidneys to cleave a chemical made by the liver. And then the product of that cleavage will be further worked on by a chemical made by lung capillaries. And that will then stimulate the adrenal glands to do something, which will then stimulate the kidneys to change their handling of potassium and salt and water. So isn't that cool? And look, it says influences blood pressure and sodium balance. So that's the only reference they said in controlling blood pressure. Also, they have to do with vitamin D absorption. And that we'll talk about more maybe tomorrow. Vitamin D is important for calcium absorption from the diet. Okay, you've got this one in the book. This is 14.1. Nice simple diagram, 14.1. Oh, that other one. Oh, that other one was table. Table 14.1. This is figure 14.1. I was going, whoa. Okay. Oh, look, there's the diaphragm. Does the diaphragm have a role in the renal system? No. But they're showing it to you so you can see where the kidneys lie in relationship to other organs. So we have two kidneys, redundant, you only need one. And we have attached to the kidneys these long tubes called ureters that lead to the bladder. And the bladder has a short tube called the urethra by which we void the urine in the bladder to the outside. And this is not in your book, but I think you have a similar picture in the book, but I don't feel it is as useful as this one. I will show you that picture from the book. The picture from the book is 14.2. So if you want to look at 14.2 while we're doing this. This shows you a cross-section of the kidney so that you can see the nephrons. This is a word you're going to want to learn, nephron. We also call the nephron a tubule, kidney tubule. And the nephrons are many. There are many, many nephrons, little things, each one associated with its own capillary bed. Okay, why capillaries and nephrons? What do they do? Let me give you a hint. What's happening in the nephron is we're pulling stuff out of the filtrate and putting it back into the bloodstream. Excuse me. So we actually have material being reabsorbed between the nephron and the blood system. So why do we have capillaries and nephrons, which have this small size? Diffusion occurs more efficiently because we have increased surface area per volume ratio. So if you take a look at the way the blood comes in, you have blood coming in an arteriole, and the arteriole, there's an afferent arteriole, which then makes a little capillary bed called a glomerulus. But this capillary bed is not to provide oxygen and sugar to the tissues. It's simply to allow filtrate to come out of the blood into the kidney tubule. The efferent arteriole carries the, it's called, still called an arteriole, because notice that we haven't given up oxygen here. So it's still an arteriole. This is just sort of a wide spot in the arteriole. And it leads to a whole collection of capillaries called the vasa recta. Vasa recta. And what that does is it collects materials that are being reabsorbed from the filtrate back into the bloodstream. And also provides oxygen to the tissues of the kidney. Okay, so this is the picture from your book. I think one of the problems I have with this picture is it's awfully busy. And you'll have to spend some time with this to figure out what's going on. So here we have the afferent arteriole coming from the artery, afferent arteriole. We have the glomerulus, which is that collection of capillaries in the start of the tubule called the Bowman's capsule, and the glomerulus then drains into the efferent arteriole, which then bifurcates into the vasa recta, which isn't noticed here. They call them peritubular capillaries, because peri means what? Around. Peritubular, they're around the tubule. And here's another feature. Let's see if I've got that right. Okay, you also have the tubule comes back and goes right between the afferent and efferent arterioles. And there's a special spot right there, and I'm going to tell you more about that. It's called the macula densa, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit. So this is just a very confusing, I think it's a confusing picture. This is the old Vander picture. I'll just show it to you so you can see what it used to look like. See, it's a lot simpler. Also, they have the macula densa there, but it shows you the direction of flow of filtrate. So the filtrate goes into Bowman's capsule from the glomerulus, and you actually have this on your 14.2. And it goes into the proximal convoluted tubule. So this is the proximal convoluted tubule. It's called convoluted because guess what? It's convoluted, right? It's called proximal because it's closest to the Bowman's structure. And then it descends into the medulla of the kidney, and this skinnier portion of the tubule is called the loop of Henle. If you study anatomy, you can too have an anatomical part named after you. So the loop of Henle descends, so it's called the descending loop of Henle. And then it goes up, and we call that the ascending loop of Henle. in the ascending loop of Henle, then goes into the distal convoluted tubule, and the distal convoluted tubule connects up with the connecting tubule, very creative name, and that goes into the cortical collecting duct and the medullary collecting duct and into the renal pelvis, which is that chamber that leads to the ureter. So that's a little review of anatomy. You guys have already done that, right, in anatomy? Just today, huh? Oh, wow, we didn't even plan that. Okay, this is 14.3 from your book. And what it's showing is the fenestrations of the capillaries in the Bowman's capsule. We had a little talk in office hours today about how some capillaries have little holes in them. They're porous, so fluids can move in and out. Does the endothelial tissue in the entire circulatory system have holes? No. Are there capillaries that don't have holes? Where, Laura? Yes.
Yeah, there are.
Oh, well, you actually said it. I thought I saw you look for me. You want to say it, Dan? Blood-brain barrier are not porous. Just because I had people complaining about that last question on the quiz. The best answer is smooth because not all endothelial tissues are porous. Okay, but these are porous. They have what's called fenestrations. What does fenestra mean in Latin?
Window,
right. So to defenestrate the cat is to throw it out the window, right? Okay, it sounds a lot nastier than it is. Okay, so the blood comes in through the afferent arteriole. It flows through the capillaries of the glomerulus. And what happens is the filtrate, no blood cells and no proteins. Basically, it shouldn't be proteins unless there's damage to the capillaries of the Bowman of the glomerulus. But what comes out then is plasma and anything that is dissolved in the plasma. And forget about the microstructure. I'm not going to. What? Did you say no?
No, I was like,
oh, okay. Yeah, I'm trying to buy time for us here, so we'll have more time to talk about sex the last day. Okay, this is the justaglomerular apparatus. You remember when I showed you on that picture that there's a place where the tubule backtracks and comes back past the afferent and efferent arterioles and goes right between them? In the distal convoluted tubule, there's a specialized region that is next to the two arterioles, and it's called the macula densa. This is 14.5 in your book. And the macula densa cells have an important function in blood pressure regulation. Whoa, how does that happen? Okay, so we have the
How are we doing for time?
Okay, good. This is going to take a while. We also have on the afferent fiber justaglomerular cells. These are a lot of funny words to learn. See, what was I going to tell you about that? I've absolutely abandoned my notes, so I have no idea where I am now. Okay. So the macula densa of the distal tubule have cells that detect salt. They can detect sodium chloride. So what they do is they figure out how much sodium chloride is in the filtrate. If you have less salt in the filtrate, the macula densa cells then figure that we have a reduced glomerular filtration rate. Now, glomerular filtration rate means how fast materials are coming out of the glomerulus. Do you think your glomerular filtration rate is related to blood pressure? Actually, it is. Yeah. The greater your blood pressure, the faster materials are going to be pushed out into bone and space. Also, you have a sympathetic nerve fiber coming to the afferent arterial too. You know, you guys look really tired. I think I'll talk about something else because this is kind of challenging. So let me talk about something else. I'm going to draw a pretty picture and you can copy that down. That. Just like kindergarten. Okay. I have my own little mechanistic picture of the tubule. So here's Bowman's capsule. And this puppy here is the, it doesn't look too convoluted, but this is your proximal part of the tubule, convoluted tubule. And then here's the narrowing part. Remember what I called this? Yep, the loop of Henle. And then, oh, that should be a little fatter there, sorry. And then we have, okay. I go home on BART just covered with ink. And the interesting thing is about here, you have a change in the saltiness. You have something called the medulla of the kidney and the cortex of the kidney. Sound familiar? Cortex refers to the outer layer of the rind, and the medulla means middle. Okay, so the cortex is where the proximal tubule works, and what the proximal tubule does is it reabsorbs all sugars, all glucose is reabsorbed into the blood from the proximal tubule. Why do we reabsorb all the sugar in the filtrate back into the body? What's the evolutionary purpose for that? Because we evolved from individuals who are struggling to get enough calories to keep body and soul together. So you may think, well, I don't want that sugar. I'm trying to lose weight. Well, no. We are evolved from individuals who didn't have enough to eat, and you wanted to not waste anything. So you didn't want to pee out any sugar. You wanted to keep that sugar. So all the glucose comes out of the proximal tubule back into the bloodstream. Also, you get water and salts for sodium. Not a whole bunch, but a respectable amount. And the salt actually helps the water come too. And we start with, we filter in all the tubules of the both kidneys. We filter 180 liters per day. How many gallons is 180 liters about? It's 40-something, isn't it? It's about 45. Is that right? 45? Yeah, 45 gallons of fluid. Those two little kidneys are doing all that work, and you just don't even appreciate it, do you? Well, you'd appreciate it if they didn't do the work, I'll tell you. Okay, so by the time we get down to the beginning of the descending loop of Henle, that filtrate is down to about 45 liters per day in all the tubules. So we go from 180 liters a day to 45 liters per day. I think that is amazing. And what you have in the descending loop is the ability to get rid of water. And what is the impulse for the kidneys to allow water to come out? Well, let me tell you. I'll tell you. There are active transporters that transport salts into the medulla. Chloride, too. So those salts then make the medulla higher osmolarity. And because of the higher osmolarity, there's less water, so we have a gradient, and the water we get, we use ATP to pump these salts into the medulla, and then the water just flows down as gradient passively for free. Then we get into the distal tubule, and we get rid of more salts, more sodium, and more water. Oh, and by the way, by the time we get here, it's about 36 liters per day. The bottom of the loop of Henle is about 36 liters per day. So by the time we get to the collecting duct, we've got about 9 liters per day, which is about 2 gallons-ish, a little more than 2 gallons. I don't know about you, but do you know anybody that goes that much? 2 gallons? You know how much a gallon is, or 9 liters? If we got rid of 9 liters a day, we would become severely dehydrated. So what we have at this last bit of the medullary collecting duct, we have transporters or pores, water pores, that are opened by a hormone you've heard of before, known as ADH, aka vasopressin. You ready to go? Go ahead and say what you really think. It's all right. Okay, we'll continue this. Oh, wait, don't move. I have a take-home quiz for you. So I'm going to turn up. What do you mean? Oh. This is a chance to get 10 points and learn some great stuff. So I'm going to turn this recording off.